Hello, Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Perspectives. This is a show that's dedicated to changing the inner sense of hope and knowing in your life so that you can rise to the exciting needs of our planet today. Opening Perspective is engaged in thought-provoking ideas, conversations, and topics that open up each and every person's unique divine purpose. You see, I believe that in everyone there is a budding of brilliance, and it's about bringing that brilliance out through invoking confidence and thought and ideas so that you can express yourself more fully, so that you can engage in ideas that open you, open your experience about what's possible. My name is Zenda Brook, and I have been doing the show off and on since January, and we've been producing a lot of things over here at the Ahuma Institute, and now we're actually able to become more effective in our timing on our show, and we're changing the format. We're going to be doing interview format for a while in our longer one-hour programs, and then we're going to be doing 15-minute shorts several times a week with an inspirational idea, message, and format that you can use the RSS feed, the podcasting feature of this program, that will allow you to get these messages on a more regular basis. Through the feedback of the listeners that we've had and the people that I have been in communication with, they really wanted us to go ahead and produce something that's smaller and shorter for them to have more in a bite-sized piece. So that's exactly what we're going to be doing. Now, today's show, we're going to be interviewing a gentleman by the name of Jim Channon. He's actually one of my favorite people on the planet, and I'm absolutely thrilled to have him. I see that he's standing by waiting to come on the air, and I want to talk a little bit about Jim as we move into this program. I'm going to bring Jim on the air so he can hear me talk about him. Hi, Jim. Are you there?
I am, Zen. Aloha.
Aloha from Hawaii. You're on the Big Island.
I'm on the Big Island. How's my volume?
Your volume sounds good to me.
Okay.
So, perfect. Wonderful. Well, let me tell everybody a little bit more about you. Jim is billed as America's first corporate shaman. He's the originator of the popular concept of corporate visioning, and he's also got a lot of credentials that need to be taken very, very seriously. He's illustrated the visions of several of the top 10 world companies, including DuPont, Whirlpool, and he is a leading futurist and educational technologist for the U.S. Army. Now, today we're going to be talking with Jim about his, is this part of your Earthrise project? I want to make sure I have that right, the village concept that we're going to be talking about today?
It is, but it's also part of social architecture, which is something I also, I'm doing a lot to create.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
Okay, we're only moments away, and what I do want to say is we're going to be taking callers if you so choose, and the guest call-in number today is 646-378-1741, 646-378-1741. And Jim, I think we should just dive right in and have you talk a little bit more about the villages and the social architecture that you're engaged in.
Great. I actually believe, just as a big idea, that it won't be long before most of this planet operates based on what I call a webocracy, meaning we have this global web, which is our intelligence system, our brain, and we go to it to find out the best solutions to anything from anywhere. And so that is where we get our instructions. But then we nestle ourselves for our life and for our joy in global villages. And more in most of the planet now, there are enough ethnic groups mixing together in places where they can gather, whether it's in a big city or a sprawling city like L.A. or a place where you only have originally a town the size of a hamlet or something very small, but where there's still a gathering place, and these will constitute the global villages. So you have a world connected by the web, but functioning in multicultural global villages. I don't think governments need to be a big part of all that.
And so talk a little bit more about why you would believe that that's something that we would be transitioning out of as larger government processes, you know, larger government.
Well, large government was a very important idea when basically conquest was governing our world. In nations in Europe, for example, and in Asia, sent their armies out to grab as much of what was remaining of the planet as they could. And then they staked territory out around those things, and they said, that's us. And so the boundaries of nations were very arbitrary. They had nothing to do with what we now call a bioregion, where you have a coherent kind of a climate and a coherent kind of vegetation. And it's something that can be managed, you know, in a very, well, clean and simple way. But we inherited all these nations which were completely arbitrary, and here's a word for you, social inventions. They were an invention that served humanity at a point in time, very much like castles served people at
right.
a point in time, you know? It was
yes.
just a socially necessary organizing function. And then, as you know, nations have now been kicked into bigger and bigger unions. There was the Soviet Union. There is an attempt now to put America, Canada, and Mexico together. So they're operating now, as many cases, as power blocks.
Right.
It's fair to say that the Muslims function pretty much with power blocks. And you could even say Christians function with power blocks, too. There are different ways they're tied together culturally. So nation is an arbitrary grouping of people, and it's going to be just too clunky in the future. And it's already, nations have gotten into our belief systems, telling us which God is their favorite, and what we're supposed to believe in, etc., and controlling commerce, and basically keeping us from seeing that for 30 years we have been a global civilization.
We have.
I know. I mean,
we have. And in fact, us, I just want to presence and see what you think, but it does seem to me that there's quite a few issues that we've had in our reaction to actually being global in nature. And if you actually look at where we're putting time and energy, it's into fighting that natural transition that we're in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, a lot of business interests, for instance, gathered themselves around the capital of countries. And they embedded themselves pretty tightly in it. So now nations are pretty well trapped into protecting all these older institutions and older corporations and whatnot. And you find in the United States, for example, that there is a death grip on extending ourselves into the planet for fear that the economic interests of various corporations, which, by the way, corporations are tribes, and they have families in them and people and kids who need lunch money and go to school and college. And, you know, we mustn't get them confused with other than people. They are just collections of people trying to do a job that got very, very big.
True.
So they became an economy, and then they had political interests, and now they're holding on for all their worth. So
well,
as the government loses its grip on our ability to organize ourselves using the web and our multicultural world, you know, you'll see these older institutions naturally coming apart as we reinvest ourselves in the countryside, get closer to the real life and soul of the land, which we all deserve, and get less programmed by the factory and goods. Have you noticed how people are now looking in a contemptuous way at all their stuff?
Like, yes.
Don't send me any presents at my birthday. I don't want any more stuff.
I don't want any more stuff. I have a lot of people that I've actually talked to who are simplifying and getting their stuff back out into the world to be reused by others. And a lot of gifting going on right now, too, I'm noticing. People saying, do you need this? It's just been sitting in my closet for 5 years. Here's an espresso maker. Anyone? You know, that kind of a thing. So I agree with you. Reuse,
yeah.
reuse.
Hazel Henderson she's a global economist, and a dame at the World Business Academy, and she examined all the things that were happening in terms of exchange on the planet, and she said 65% that all the things that are made by one person and given to the other are still done for love. And that's cooking and, you know, families dressing their children and whatnot. We just have been programmed by the commercial system to think that everything functions on money. No, about 10% of it functions on money. And we're going to get closer to back to a bartering system, a trade system, an exchange system, a recycling system, until at some point maybe, well, money is actually pretty magic in some ways. So we can talk about that if you want. But
actually, I want to talk about your concept for Global Villages, and I want to let people know that there's information on this at youtube.com under Jim Channon. And Channon is spelled C-H-A-N-N-O-N. And so if you go to YouTube, you'll actually get graphics that Jim has drawn and an explanation of various concepts so that you can back up your education around this. And we're also going to talk a little bit about the new movie that's coming out or being purchased by George Clooney and his partner on the book that you were named in, but we'll hold that off for a little bit longer. So
okay.
Talk to me a little bit about the Global Villages.
Well, you hear the expression all the time, it takes a village.
Yes.
And I think my understanding of that is that in your bringing children up, and they have enough other people to observe beside you in the family, they will learn their behavior without you having to beat them over the head with it.
Right.
And the number of people that are available to support their behavior or correct their behavior takes a huge load off the parents, you know, in this case. So how many people is that? Well, in my just general, I think I've been through 1,000 villages in my life, honestly, on 4 continents. I mean, everything from, I've been in 2, villages that were actually Stone Age, meaning there wasn't a sign of metal in the village.
Wow.
One in China and one in Upper Vietnam. I've also been in Italian villages where, you know, they've been carved in stone on the side of a hill for 1,000 years. And also Greenwich Village, which is in the middle of New York. Melrose Avenue, which is in the middle of L.A.
So true, so true.
And Mill Valley, which is in the middle of, Mill Valley, but there are 5 villages in Mill Valley based on which mall you're centering. If there's a outdoor cafe, a coffee shop, a gathering place, a little improv music, a place where people are a little more important than cars, you know, where vendors can come and set up without a whole lot of rules, like in the ancient marketplace, and sell
yes.
things off the back of their trucks, where there's a little bit of an organization about all that, like that happens every Saturday. So we begin to get some order into the system. And it used to be that there was a church steeple you could see from 10 miles away, and that the church bell told everybody when it was noon, you know, when they could take an hour off of work. And there was a clock in town back when there was only one clock in the whole town. So some elements of the village, you know, are nice when they have those features in them.
Right.
We have in my town... it's 2 blocks long in one direction and 1 block long in the other direction. We have about 15 businesses, but there are 9 ethnic origins in the businesses. There are 7 different kinds of ethnic food. There is a Saturday market, you know. There are 2 to 4 bands that play every Friday night, so you can do a little bit of a pub crawl.
Right, exactly.
And we
Which
have
is not,
no,
yes.
We have no traffic light.
Right. Well, you are located in the Big Island of Hawaii, and it is quite a bit of a different, everyone knows the island atmosphere is a bit different, but how do you actually see us migrating from where we are now into villages, and why do you find that to be what you believe our important next step is?
Well, commercially, the smart merchants are always going to place their businesses where the traffic is. The traffic is becoming more excited about moving around in a global marketplace rather than a purely Western marketplace. There are many big malls in the Midwest, but they're all giant buildings, and they're all based on merchandising, and there is no culture in them.
Right.
You go to Venice in California, you go to places where there's more of an ethnic mix, and that's where the people are going. It's just more interesting.
Yes.
And then if there's, you know, if the cars are held at bay and there are a few musicians and even some street buskers, you know, there's some interesting archetypical people and a place to sit and watch them, that's going to be the draw. And everybody, if they don't have to drive 80 miles to the big city, which, by the way, doesn't feel very much like a culture anymore because, you know, God, parking underground, walking through controlled lights, hearing beeping horns, where's the charm? So if you can get the same array of goods and food and fun in a one-block area out of town, you're not going to town anymore. Or the
yeah.
city. So it's a natural migration of interest. I mean, notice how it used to be that seaports is where all the cool stuff was because that's where the transportation system was. Now when you go into an airport, you just look at all the shops that are in the airport. And the more the shops are there, all of a sudden there's this new thing where there's 7 kinds of ethnic food in the little food mart, you know.
Oh, yeah. Or I just have to say that our airports are actually getting more and more appetizing to stay in. As I'm traveling, which I know that's exactly what you're talking about, as I'm out traveling, if I had a 2-3 hour layover, I used to figure out how to get myself into the town, even if I just got to walk around for an hour and get the feel or the vibe of the place.
Yeah.
But now what I'm finding is actually there's great little mini villages happening inside of some of the airports that I'm traveling to.
Absolutely.
And I get to meet interesting people right there. It's not as hectic because they do build airports farther and farther outside of towns nowadays. And it's been quite lovely.
Yeah, yeah. And that's going to continue. There's like air traffic may go down a little bit, but I think it's a perfect example of what people want, which is the variety, the ability to sit down, people watch, enjoy a little higher energy, a little bit more mixed energy, you know, have the food they like the best, it's special, they can't make it at home, and not be a victim of traffic and noise and
right.
light, mechanical things. Yeah.
So I know that you've been engaged actively in creating this village scenario in your town.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about what people can do that would support them in creating this for themselves?
Well,
beginning
in
at least the conversation of it.
Yeah. Well, in our case, I walked in 1989 to a ghost village. Potentially it was a village, but it was a ghost town because only 3 of the 15 older buildings, which had an architecturally uniform period feeling to them, and I just got a hold of the biggest building I could that had the most potential charm.
Hello? Did we lose you? Well, it seems as if we might have lost Jim for the moment in his Hawaiian hideaway here. One of the things that, and I'm sure he'll be right back here, one of the things that I wanted to mention about Jim is that he has an Earthrise project, which is a 100-year vision for the planet and its transformation. And like I was saying earlier, on YouTube.com, under Jim Channon, you'll find that he has outlined beautifully this Earthrise project so that you can follow along on what it's going to take for us to move forward. Now, I wanted to, as I said earlier, Jim is one of the top futurist. He's been thinking about this for the past 30 years. He comes from a military background as well as a transformational background. So if you have an opportunity to go to YouTube and look at the videos that he's done there explaining his concepts around what is possible for our transition, and you'll find that at Earthrise. He did that with a wonderful organization. And so it's a fantastic... Oh, there you are. It's a fantastic opportunity for you to check out Jim and see him live, because he's quite a handsome man, I just want to say. So, can't help it, Jim. It's true. It's true. You've got that, you know, cross between kind of like Sean Connery, Harrison Ford, but better.
Oh, now I'll do more shows if you want.
I thought you'd love it. All right, so go ahead.
Well,
if you would.
My smart telephone decided it was going to do something else. You know how machines are telling us what to do all the time these days. So.
It's true. It's true. So you were talking about how you walked into your little Hawaiian village, and it was a ghost village. And I know that the economic times had pretty much shifted. In Hawaii, in the northern area that you were in, and it had fallen on hard economic times, this particular area that you were in, and you went in and you said you bought the biggest building you could find is where we actually had the drop-off?
Yeah, well, it was the biggest building, not just because of volume, but because of its presence. It had a kind of, it's an old Western-looking gunsmoke building, which is actually a Japanese mercantile architecture, but it had a banner, sort of a big extended area above the second floor where I could write the name of the town up there. I could do some heraldry. So what I decided, and if you want to bring a place back, you do need to build what I call an altarpiece. You have to show people by taking something that's there, making it beautiful again and attractive. And by the way, the most economical way to recycle is to restore something. It is paint. Yes, it sometimes is glass and wood, but it's mostly paint and then bringing a combination. We brought in the combination of food, a Pacific food, combination of the local Hawaiian culture and music, a gallery for the local artist, and a gift shop. Now, that was the combination that we guessed was going to bring some tourists up the road. And sure enough, it took a couple of years. And now 37 buildings in both this town and the next one are restored. There practically isn't unrestored. There's
the
one
town.
Unrestored building.
Huh? What's the town? What's the name of the town in the Big Island?
As you drive up the western coast from Kona, it's past the harbor at Kauai High. It's the town of Hawi and the town of Kapa'au, just north.
And I really encourage people to go up there and see this beautiful little village. It's got some of the best hiking and canyon down to this beach that's glorious. And one of the best restaurants on the island located there, correct?
Well, yeah, and it's mostly because of the service and because Joan Shannon, who runs the place, is, by the way, you know, runs it like a little mystery school. And those local kids that are in there serving you will actually yell at each other in local style while you're eating and give you a flavor of the place as a culture. And they'll tease you in such a way that if you're sitting there, you figure out somehow or other your family. They're treating you like family because they're teasing you. And, well, that's how she built a huge clientele over the years. And yes, well, the recession's here and the traffic's down a little bit, but it's a pretty steady ship. And the fact that everybody sort of in town got the idea and got their paint out, and then because there was a kind of an eclectic people drawn to this beautiful island, are kind of, they're not tourists as much as travelers, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
Been enough places so where they're pretty discerning about what's desirable in terms of climate and culture, etc. And so they populated the place, and with their cosmopolitan heads, they made all these amazing stores. There's a Chinese store that's absolutely the best place to buy tea service.
Oh, I love that store. I love it. I know exactly which one you're talking to.
There's a sushi place with Italian sauce. You know, there's a Tibetan jewelry shop that has Swarovski crystal. You know, it isn't the generica store.
Right. No Walmarts, no 7-Elevens. It's a village.
No.
It's where everybody gets to come and give their passion.
Yeah.
Yeah, just like it used to be.
And then we have musicians that do now sit in at the coffee shop. And we didn't have one of those either until one just kind of worked across the street. And we have improv on Saturday night. And it's a function of the kind of people that were attracted to come back to the country, live in fresh air, you know, be able to have a garden and basically get their soul back, because most people actually, this may sound a little preposterous. If I were to ask people if they have a soul, most people would just have to really raise their eyebrows and think about that question. But if I talk to somebody in the country who's planted something and eaten what they planted and made their own landscape around them and sat by the river and smelled the fresh air and know their own birds and know their own wind, as the Hawaiians used to say, and know their own rain, you ask those people if they have a soul and they'll just smile at you. You know, the industrial world was a really interesting thing, but are you there?
I am here. I'm here.
Oh.
Loving.
I have to check my smart little phone. did I communicate that all right?
I think you did. I think one of the yes, of course, yes, you did. And I want to just share a little story around my own little town here in Oakland, which is a city area. But we have this little center called Lakeshore. Lakeshore and Grand. It's by Lake Merritt. And we had this one street where there's some shops and coffees and restaurants, and it was interesting because there was this little triangular patch of land. And what I mean by little, I'm talking no more than two cars would be able to fit on this triangular patch of land, right?
Uh-huh.
And the local community members, a few of them who were retired, got together and got permission from the city to put in a tiny little park. And I mean tiny. And they went out and they started talking to people at the local Pete's Coffee about what they wanted to do. They got people to donate $20, $30, $40 as they were kind of walking through and told them about what they wanted to do and what a difference it would make. And then they bought the materials together. They all got together over a weekend. They tore up all they picked up all the trash. They tore up all the weeds. It was just a plot of weeds that people had a path to walk through to cut kind of to their cars. They planted a tree. They put in three benches and a little checkers table where people could sit and play chess or checkers in the shade. They put in a trash can, and they put in an area to tie up your bike, to rack up your bike. And it was such an amazing thing to not only watch the community come together, but people go and sit there all the time. And they meet each other on the street, and they'll be talking, and you watch them. I've watched them from the coffee shop migrate over to the little park area, sit down for 10 or 15 minutes, talk, and then be on their way. And it became this beautiful little center. And within about a year, they all got together and started a splash pad for a farmer's market.
Yeah.
And they made this beautiful little marketplace that it took them about a year. They really took it on with this one little success. And now every Saturday they have live music. They have a playground for the kids that gets kind of brought in with slides and jumpy things. And then the other thing is that they have this fresh farmer's market, organic, and everybody comes and walks in, and the place is hopping every single Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't take a lot, and we have all this beautiful unused talent of our retiring population who have such an ability to do so much. That I just really, like, what part of the conversation that I, am so loving about that you're bringing into this is your ability to witness how to use untapped resources in a way that creates a future we desire and can't wait to live in.
invite them into a certain space.
Yes.
I did 20 improv festivals in an amphitheater that I carved out of my own little plot of land here. And what I came to realize after time as a social architect is that you want people to feel alive and comfortable in a certain space. You have to treat the space in layers. For instance, if the space has enough green life in it, you know, where you can actually feel the vibrance of the plant life, and then some color, and then a little music, and then interesting pathways that aren't just sidewalks, and then a little water feature, and at night a couple of torches, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then something ethnically interesting, and then even, you know, one of my favorite tricks was to include a clown, or a fool is a better word, at the beginning of these festivals, who would come up on stage and make sure that everyone in the audience knew that they could be as silly, as free, and as fumbling as the fool. And that told them right away that they had permission to relax and be goofy.
And play.
And play.
And play.
So, yeah. And walking around, you know, occasionally in a mall, you'll see somebody in a clown's outfit. Well, darn it, that really makes a big difference because it models the human behavior that is acceptable. And so it goes. And so in my work as a social architect, I look for ways to layer gathering places with these vital elements that stimulate the senses, give people permission to be a certain way, invite them to linger, you know, give them just enough interest if they have to buy a little something before they go home to finish dinner, you know. All
yes.
those little things together make up social architecture, which is distinct from regular architecture, where you're trying to design something to perform a given function. Like the regular architect would be designing where the kitchen would go in relationship to the street, in relationship to the parking lot, and where the pipes would go in, and the air would go out, you know, et cetera.
Yeah.
The social architect says, wait a minute, what kind of feelings do I want people to have in this space while they're there?
Right.
And what state of being do we want to encourage? And I'm not saying it's only one kind of state of being. But, and you know, the same thing was done in churches for years, where people recognized that if they wanted to move the human spirit in a certain way, they needed a choir, you know, and they needed an organ. And stained glass windows, by the way, color is a huge, powerful instrument in bringing.
Yes.
And color with light coming through it, hello.
Yes.
Stained glass
yes.
windows. And so, you know, this is not a new idea, how we gather people together and support their intentions and create a culture with that.
So I want to do a tiny bit of transition, and once again, I want to, you know, remind everybody that I very much encourage you to check out more of Jim Channon's work, Channon, at YouTube, and some of the videos that he has to just kind of start sparking ideas on a deeper level within your own life. But what we're talking about here today is about, you know, how to start bringing back our village atmosphere in our local lives. And one of the things that I think inhibits that, and Jim, I'd love to present this with you because I'm coming up with a new theme of conversation that I want to begin having with people, and it's about cults, C-U-L-T-S. We're not talking about the occult, but we're talking about cults and what a cult is. And a lot of people think it's some, you know, bizarre religious organization that is underground with weird beliefs and a leader that's pulling the wool out of everyone's eyes and all of that. And I'm not saying that doesn't exist. But for me, as I'm looking around the planet, what I'm witnessing is we have a multitude of cults that most of us are engaged in any given time. And, you know, can I do you mind having a little conversation around that with me?
Oh, that'd be great.
Okay.
Because I did a lot of that work with large corporations.
Right.
Because they had their vision, and they knew what they wanted, where they wanted to go and what they wanted to achieve. They needed to get the compliance of the culture, the group of people, to translate that vision into daily behavior, blah, 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 so we can go there.
Right, which that's creating a culture, which is very
yeah.
much like a cult. I have friends, you know, that's where the word cult actually comes from, is culture.
Yeah.
And like cult of personality, that kind of thing. And I have people who work for, you know, various pharmaceutical companies and IBM and so forth. And I've had these conversations where I talk about cults and they say, wow, my workplace is a cult.
Sure.
We have a way of dressing that to be accepted, to be able to move forward in the organization. There's a way of thinking. There's a way of talking. There's a way we do meetings. And if you do not engage in the cult behavior that everyone else is engaging in, you get demoted, you get put to the back of the room, or you get let go of. They don't promote you. They don't even want you in the organization. And so what I'm talking about is a definition before we dig into this piece here is what I'm talking around a definition is it being defined as a group that has certain characteristics such as, you know, psychological coercion of some sort or indoctrination and an ability to retain its members. It's where there is a culture or a practice of how to behave and be being built. A cult believes that the end justifies the means.
Ooh.
Okay, that's one thing that is very much about that. And then, you know, also it's an elitist or a totalitarian type of organization or society. And oftentimes, which is interesting, I'm going to presence this before we move forward, but oftentimes its wealth of the cult does not benefit the members or society.
Mm.
So these are all, you know, so to remain within like kind of strict mental confines of what most organizations or Christian organizations define as a cult, which the Christian organizations define as anything that leads people away from Jesus and following God, I want to open that up in a social way to a larger context.
Mm.
And one of the reasons I'm actually doing this, okay, is because I believe that we're engaged in a cult of consumerism.
Mm.
Versus a cult of citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of what you're talking about here is, in my opinion, you know, and I have somebody in the chat room here who's talking about mind control and beware. And actually, if you actually look at the consumer cult in just the United States alone, there's a certain way where we're marketed to, we're mentally influenced, we're being pushed to buy, our legislation is being driven by consumerism, not citizenship, with the lobbyists. You look at the oil culture that goes in and is engaged with that, and the way that it's been, other ideas of forms of energy have been pushed out quite forcefully, which
yeah.
is something that happens. Things that take away from the power of the cult gets pushed outside of the cult and denied or detracted from.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole undermining of citizen. And in your discussion around villages, what you're really doing is you're creating citizenship, which is self-responsibility, active engagement, striving towards equality, acknowledgement, and participation of all the community members, and everyone having a voice in the experience of what the culture should look like, be like, for its members versus one outside kind of group pushing it on it.
Yeah.
What do you think of that conversation?
Well, in my study of communications, there isn't a human being that, whether it's conscious and usually isn't, who isn't trying to program the people around him or her in a way that supports their life. So to say that some people are controlling and other people are controlling is pretty naive. Everybody's controlling.
Exactly.
And it doesn't mean that it couldn't be perfectly good, clear, purposeful, useful, but obviously it can go rotten. The same thing is true with many organizations that are very strong, have initiatory rights, you know, have an exclusivity, etc. But if the guy in charge, you know, gets wacky or the group is endangered, they turn the dials of this organization, which is very tightly integrated and programmed to a degree, and they can say, those guys over there are bad now. If they attack us, we will kill them. So good culture can turn sour in a short period of time with the proper threat. And what people, I think, need to be aware of is that all organizations that want to function in a really powerful way use culture to integrate people and make them feel like they belong and give them common uniforms and common greetings and flags and symbols and music. I mean, the army could not function if it wasn't a strong culture, because war is just, I was in combat 317 days. It's really stupid out there. It's really crazy. It's really dangerous. And if you're not bonded together, thinking only of each other and your mission, the whole thing just disappears. You become totally victimized by the situation.
Well, it's not that there isn't, yes, and I absolutely agree with you. There is a way in which, so the reason why this conversation is important to me is because there is a lack of choice in free thinking, and I don't mean free thinking in a woo-woo way. I mean free thinking in the minds that we need to solve the problems we're in are not allowed to be free thinking enough to support them in making a difference. And that is very much, as I'm looking around the planet, I'm seeing these cult-type atmospheres that are limiting our ability to maneuver and be flexible, which is another outline of a cult situation, is its members are not allowed to be flexible in their thinking and their engagement of relationships with others.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. So it's not about whether or not you belong to a cult anymore, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It's about which cults do you belong to, and choose your cults wisely. And I understand that there's a very small, limited group of negative cults out there, which are, I would say, more indoctrinated religious mind control cults. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about culture and the way that it's subdivided in the on the planet.
Right.
And how that subdivision is being bought into without even a second thought by many, many, many people.
Correct.
And that is absolutely limiting our capacity to act quickly, utilize opportunities and free thinking, intelligent forms of thinking that's out there.
Yep.
And also, they're not even being looked at. It's almost like a subversive kind of thing. Don't look at the oil cult that's happening in the world today. Is basically, we'll change scientific documents to prove that the oil cult that we're engaged in is not the problem, right?
Oh,
the FDA is a cult, in my opinion.
Right.
I've had so many people talk about the way that they've changed research studies that have come out to say, oh, you know, this amount of fat per day is okay. And actually it's not. It's creating obesity all over the planet, all over the United States, right?
Yeah. Well, I think that there is a generation, 30s to 40s, that really know the difference between the truth and slick advertising. They can smell a program that way really quickly in an ad, in a 30-second commercial or something like that, or a slick magazine ad. They're very wary of that, but they are not as wary as you suggest, and rightfully so, of how that works at a bigger level, at a national level, the programming. For instance, if the administration has the right to change the word global warming to the word climate change, and they do, and they
did.
And they did. they can continue to reframe our thinking about what's going on. If they likewise can limit our information to, say, other global newspapers, they can control our idea about how well our economy is doing. And people generally, you're right, are not savvy enough to smell this all out.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And
they're
not
savvy enough.
I believe that they are savvy enough if they're given the right information as a context to be thinking in to make effective choice.
Correct.
So, for instance, you know, it's one thing that we have terrorism, and I have no disagreement that terrorism, you know, I was a foreign policy major in college, and the main threat that we studied, because it was right in between when communism had fallen, and we were looking at what was the next thing that we needed to be paying attention to on a foreign policy level for the United States.
Hmm.
And it was terrorism. And this is back in 96, 97.
Right.
95, right in that era, and
yeah.
It was terrorism. And so I actually did a lot of research and papers and study and conversations on terrorism. It is a viable issue that needs to be looked at, okay?
Yeah.
Two warring
yeah.
cults, right, kind of a thing. You've got to pay attention to it. However, when you begin to have people that utilize the fear factor, create what is American and what is un-American. Being a patriot is now considered un-American, and you can be put on the terrorist list for that. To me, that's a consumer culture issue. That is a fear issue, not a citizen issue. If you take patriot in a citizen cult, where people are taking responsibility for what their nation does and standing on their own values and assessing and determining that the nation that they're engaged in as a citizen, those values need to be involved, that those are the values need to be in the culture of the nation versus a consumer culture where you're looking at how is this going to affect our trade and our economic situation. And we found that the consumer culture isn't actually supporting us economically as a nation. The consumer culture is what's producing the Walmart and the Starbucks that have killed the small coffee shops and destroyed the local businesses.
Right.
A citizen culture wouldn't have determined that that was a viable aspect to be engaged in.
Hmm.
You see what I'm saying? There's a whole different way of thinking.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's about what context, if you're going to be a part of the cult, you know, and I'm going to outline this effectively in the coming year, choose your cults wisely and prepare a context for what you actually stand for.
Right.
And it needs to have an effective understanding of the vision of where those actions are going to take you. And we understand where the consumer cult is taking us. We're watching the environment get destroyed. We're watching our rights be destroyed. We're watching livelihoods, creative activities, and communities be degraded by the consumer cult that we're all engaged in, mind-washed into, that all of our buy, something new every single year, here's the latest and greatest, throw the rest
right.
into the landfill.
Yeah, well, it started, you know, after World War II, we were a pretty shell-shocked nation. And they started this experiment, I think it's on Long Island, called Levittown. And they said, well, we'll give everybody a little ranch house without much property, and a garage for their car, and we'll see that they have a car, place for their car. And by the way, that will be a cluster. And there was no village center in that at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, because they wanted those people to be workers. And by the way, just down the highway from them was the factory.
Right.
They all sort of found their way to working at. And by the way, then the malls came in, which was 20 minutes in another direction. But again, did not allow them to meet together. So they all got the idea that, well, John next door doesn't have any more than we do, so we must be okay. And this was the beginning of turning everybody not only into consumers, but into laborers to some degree, and all happy laborers, if you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
I mean, it was probably the most communistic thing you could probably do. and even communism works in some places. You know, capitalism is overrated in America, but still works better than most of the other things. But,
right.
But the margin of victory is small. We need just like in any other endeavor, we need to integrate a little bit of the best parts of capitalism, a little bit of the best parts of communism, a little part of the webocracy. You know, it's like you always have to build that next combination. And I think what you're saying is that if people build their affiliations with groups around them, and that could be even virtual groups on the web,
yes,
to check into the primary belief system, the higher purpose of the group, perhaps, and shake down the behaviors for yourself that seem to be programmed or ordered or stiff or separating them from their ability to join a second group, you know, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's a polyphonic world that is more healthy for us.
Define polyphonic. It's you in those words that I love so much. I have to ask you to define it.
Well, poly just means many. And phonic means sound, and meaning part of many tongues, part of the global village, part of, in my town there are 42 ethnic groups of people who live in 7,000 people live here, and on the voting thing there are 42 ethnic groups. That's polyphrenic and polycultural. You know, polycultural is the word,
yes.
I think I'm looking for here.
Yes, polycultural.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to bring in something really quick. This is very an interesting little side note. We've only got 8 minutes left,
I
want to just bring in one little side note. You talk about the way that houses and neighborhoods were created not as villages but as centers for workers to get to and from a factory instead of having a livelihood and a life.
Yeah.
And I remember one of the things that really shocked me was they had this beautiful little island town where there was a factory there or a business there. And this is years and years ago, and people weren't coming to work as often as they'd like. You might have heard of this study, and the business wanted people to show up on time and be there. And so what they ended up doing is they brought in these consultants. The consultants went around and interviewed everybody and looked at everything, and they came back to the business owner and they said, "What can we do? What do we need to put into place? What do we need to do to solve this situation?" They said, "Well, our assessment is you need to put Sears and Roebuck catalogs on every table in every break room and make sure that it's always the newest edition is always there." And the business owner's like, "What? I've paid you all this money for that?" And they said, "Do it. It'll work." They put these Sears Roebuck catalogs where people could order things, and people started buying things on credit. They started increasing their need to pay their bills. They started having to work every single day. And it completely shifted the culture of the town that it was on.
Yeah.
So,
well, I can see that where you're sort of going with all that, and if we want to pay attention to what the earth is telling us in no uncertain terms, that now that we've built this lovely commercial grid around the whole planet and these generic stores and all of this attraction with credit cards to consume, what is the culture that will bring us back to the country?
Yes, exactly. Or at least even creating the village atmosphere within the cities. That's totally possible with all of the various information we have on rooftop gardens and transforming our schoolyards into organic farms that our children can get back to them and so forth. Before we go, because we're coming to the end of our show today, I do want to just give you a little thumbs up around George Clooney being interested in the book. And it's not your book, and I understand, but you're showcased in it, as well as Earthrise and the programs that in the military work that you did. If you guys want to read a very interesting book, check out Men Who Stare at Goats. Who's the author of that again?
That's John Ronson, Men Who Stare at Goats. And John's about half right with most of the book, but it doesn't mean it's an uninteresting read.
It's a great read. You know, it's a fun read, and they're also going to be doing a movie about the read, and it's about how the military was looking at various transformational and spiritual technologies and things to be able to try and kill a goat with their eyes and things. But Jim Channon's noticed in the book, and they've created a screenplay from it that was recently voted by the CANS community as being the most interesting unproduced screenplay.
Yeah.
that's sitting there ready to be ready to be created. And I guess George Clooney and his partner have recently purchased that, and so who knows what's going to happen there, but it would be fantastic to go ahead and check that out. And then, Jim, will you talk a little bit more about where they can pick up some of the information? The First Earth Battalion is a great, interesting manual that you've created that's free online, and it's got fantastic ideas. You want to go ahead and talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. FirstEarthBattalion.org is a new website I've just had to put together because there's been, the other day after 30 years of the First Earth Battalion being in place, I looked on the web, I Googled myself, and I thought, my gosh, there are like 400 to 500 people out there that are telling me who I am and what I've done. I thought I better make my own website. So FirstEarthBattalion.org will get you to the story and to the ideas and to the book and the manual and almost, you can get a link to everything I've done there pretty much.
It's all pretty much free, right?
You
can download a lot of it?
You can download a lot from the web. And on my site, I have a few things for sale because, I need to pay for a few things like the website. But
yes.
You can get plenty of information without buying anything. I just put a new global Marshall Plan on that website too, and there's the 100-year vision for the planet. So,
well, I'm going to personally check that out again because I've looked through all of that, and it is a brilliant, lots of brilliant information in there, and it's effective. And then also, once again, the YouTube. Like I said earlier, Jim Channon on YouTube, and that's spelled Channon for anyone who's just turning in. And you can contact Jim through his sites there, which if you want to talk to him further or have any projects or ideas or things, I'm sure he could help you find people that would support you in what you're doing. Jim, this has been lovely, as usual. Can you believe that was already an hour? We don't even have commercial breaks, and it goes by so fast.
I know. It's always that way with you. Love it.
Me too. I love it. It's great.
Let's talk again. There's plenty to talk about.
Yes, and next week I'm doing a show. I'm the featured showcase alone next week, and I'm doing it on feminine leadership. And what are the principles of feminine leadership? It's been quite fascinating to me to watch how women have tried and attempted to step into male leadership as a role, and it doesn't quite work. We are a different embodied creatures, and having been in leadership roles now for years, I've been cultivating what feminine leadership is, and so the next show is on men, women, feminine leadership, sex, and power, which is quite a topic. So I hope
I hope you study from those steel magnolias down south. I could possibly imagine anything. Now you go right on upstairs and sit down. I'm gonna bring you a cookie.
Exactly. You know what? And the interesting thing is you're not so far off.
Well,
you're not so far off.
Leadership.
It takes leadership, and it takes utilizing the beauty of femininity and feminine appetite for paradise as the inspiration for production.
Yeah, and I hope it can bring back coyness and flirting and swishy skirts. And by the way, we do follow the swishy skirt.
Yes, I know you do. Well, I'm definitely going to be bringing back, on a different note, joy, happiness, inspiration, feminine mother attributes.
Yes.
Of care and nurturing and support and all of that is definitely part of the feminine leadership role, and it's very powerful. There's a reason why the patriarchy had such a reaction to feminine leadership in the past, and so next week we're going to get to talk about that.
Well, as it relates to this conversation, making the space, homemaking,
yes,
is what we're talking about in the middle of the villages. It is the attractive place.
So we're about to go off the air. Jim,
yep.
As usual,
yep.
I've had a great time. I absolutely love you. And just so you know, I'll be in Hawaii in the next, like, 3 months. I'm definitely going to come up and spend some time in your oasis.
Great.
And lay in the hammock and have lots of beautiful, lush conversation.
Go planet!
Okay, bye-bye for now. Thank you so much.
Bye, Zan.
Bye.
Aloha.
Aloha.